We have, in the past few weeks, covered quite a good bit of ground, and you have now heard, and I hope studied, the periodontal ligament, the alveolar bone, oral mucosa. We have heard about eruption, and now with all of these little bits of information in the background, today we are going to put it together on a very important topic, and that is the marginal periodontium. In the past, we really didn't use to have this as a separate subject, but the marginal periodontium clinically is a very critical area. And all of the various pieces that I just mentioned come into play when we look at it. And so consider now this as kind of a almost something where all the information that you had in the last few weeks is coming together. Let's begin with a definition. And a definition is a simple one. Essentially, when we talk about marginal periodontium, we identify that as all of the periodontal tissues. It excludes the tooth itself, although it does, of course, interact with it. But all the periodontal tissues that are located above or occlusal to the alveolar rim. And so what is included in this is the gingiva, and that would be all of the attached gingiva, all of the free gingiva and part of the attached. The supraalveolar fiber groups, which we already have encountered before, and now we are going to look at them very specifically. And then the very important topic of the dentogingival sulcus and the dentogingival attachment. And we'll talk about the role of the junctional epithelium, which is one of the major players in this area. So if we look at this graphically, the... Okay, people? If you're going to come to the lecture, do not come 10 minutes late, please. Thank you. Okay. The marginal periodontium is essentially everything above this stippled line in this diagram, okay? The supraalveolar fiber groups, we can be brief about that because you already know a lot about it. Yesterday, groups A and B, we had a discussion about them. And what we find in the supraalveolar fiber groups is that those are the fibers that come from the most cervical part of the tooth, that is in the periodontium. And there is... These are the fibers that are located occlusal to the alveolar crest fibers. So the alveolar crest fibers are here. And then the gingival fibers are the fibers that are coming from the cervical part of the root. And they go in this view, which is in a labiolingual view. Only then can you see all of those groups. And you see that there are three groups. The groups that are going into the free gingiva. That's one group. Then there is a group that is going out like this, and they go into the lamina propria of the attached gingiva mostly. And finally, the third group goes down here and actually becomes incorporated in the fibrous periosteum of the alveolar bone. If it is the outer cortical bone, it will be the fibrous periosteum of that outer cortical bone plate that you have there, or the inner cortical bone, whatever it is. But you only see all of these three groups in a labiolingual view. If you do not have a labiolingual view, but you have a mesiodistal section, for example, then you only have the free gingival fiber. So in the case of the mesiodistal, we don't have this. Okay? So that is the difference between the two. And then, of course, the other fibers, which are kind of running along with this, are the circumferential fibers. They are a little harder to see because what you have to look for are specific locations where you see cross-sectioned fiber bundles. But they are literally arranged between those gingival fiber groups. They are starting on the root surface, same as the others. They are inserting in the acellular extrinsic fiber cementum. And then they are running for a while around the neck of the tooth, and then at some point they are spinning out and attaching to the gingiva. So ultimately the circumferential fibers do attach to the gingiva, but they do it after they have run for a while peripherally and circumferentially to the root surface. Another group of fibers that is part of this are the transeptal fibers. We discussed them already when we talked about the periodontal ligament, but by the definition of marginal periodontium, which is that anything above the alveolar crest is marginal periodontium, clearly the transeptal fibers are marginal periodontium as well. So we include that in this group. Now, that is the bare minimum of the fibers that you are responsible for. I just want you to know that in this area there are so many other fiber groups that we actually can discuss, but you really don't have to know. What you really should know is that in this region everything connects to everything. Okay? That's the basic statement. And so what you're having is, of course, the alveolar crest fibers we already knew about. But then you have the gingival fibers. Now this is a mesiodistal section, so only have the gingival fibers going into the free gingiva. Then you have fibers that are going from the alveolar crest into the gingiva. There's a whole group that we don't even mention. You have the circumferential fibers, which you are seeing here. And then you have fiber groups that if you're looking here in this direction, they run from the one interdental papilla to another interdental papilla. So they are literally running between papillae, tying them together. And here are fibers that are running from the attached gingiva on one side to the attached gingiva on the other side. From the free gingiva on one side to the free gingiva on the other. I mean, just think about it. Whatever particular kind of connection you can make, you can be assured that there are fibers that are that way. Everything is really tied to everything else. And this diagram here shows it, and it shows you like something like 8 or 9 different fiber groups. Of course you are not going to be responsible for it, that would be idiotic. But the thing is that you should at least know the 3 groups that I mentioned before. The gingival fibers with the 3 subgroups, the circumferential fibers, and the transeptal fibers. Those are the ones that you are responsible for. Now, let's now talk about the gingiva. Yesterday we talked about masticatory mucosa and lining mucosa, and we mentioned the fact that the attached gingiva is an example of masticatory mucosa. And then we also mentioned the fact that the alveolar mucosa is an example of lining mucosa. Okay? That's just a refresher of what we did yesterday. And between each of these, subsets, and then, of course, I'm sorry, then the free gingiva is located at the top where the gingival epithelium actually curves around and then faces the tooth surface. So that's the part that we call free gingiva. And so between the free gingiva and the attached gingiva, you have a free gingival line, and that is actually clinically visible, and I'll show it to you. And between the attached gingiva and the alveolar mucosa, you have another line, the mucogingival line. Now, the mucogingival line stands out because it is a boundary between attached gingiva and attached mucosa. It is the boundary between masticatory mucosa and lining mucosa. And so that's a very distinctive line. The free gingival line is a little bit more subtle, but again, you can see it, and I'll show you an example of that. Here is the clinical view. And it is not everywhere equally well visible, but there are areas where you can see it. And what you're seeing here is, there's a little line here. And you can actually follow this through. And here is the outline, and there's another line. And so the stippled line that I drew here, I was a little bit probably too high on the free margin, but it's fair enough. The stippled line is the free gingival line. And so what is above here, which is in a healthy person about 2 millimeters, that is known as the free gingiva. Okay? The mucogingival line is this line here, which is very easy to draw because anything above it is attached gingiva, and this is the alveolar mucosa. Okay, and you can see the distinctive difference between lining mucosa and masticatory mucosa. Same thing here. Look, very sharply present. You see the attached gingiva is masticatory mucosa, is much paler, and in the healthy condition has these little orange peel appearance. So that is something that you look for. If the gingiva is swollen, that orange peel appearance disappears, and the gingiva also usually becomes redder. So you know that you are dealing with pathology. So that is the distinction. We have free gingiva and attached gingiva and alveolar mucosa, and the three are separated by two distinct lines. Now, we are going to look today mostly at the free gingiva, and as you see, there is a festooning of that free gingiva around the root, and that is the marginal free gingiva is here. And then between the teeth, you have a papilla, interdental papilla, and that is the papillary free gingiva. So the free gingiva is further subdivided into the marginal free gingiva, which is just a parallel band of about 2 millimeters in the healthy situation. And then the papillary free gingiva is where you have the interdental papillae. Now, several of you have already discussed with me, and so I know this is a topic that you are aware of, but you just need to make sure that you fully understand it. The interdental papillae are paired. In other words, between each set of teeth, you have a labial interdental papilla, but you also have an interdental papilla on the palatal or lingual side. So if you look at a tooth in a labiolingual direction, there will be an interdental papilla on this side, which you're seeing here, but there will be also a separate interdental papilla on the lingual or palatal side. In between is the col, and that is a structure that we'll mention in a little while. I want to go back to it for a moment, to this diagram here, because you actually see it here. We yesterday talked about it several times. The col is this area between the two papillae. See, here is one papilla, one interdental papilla. Here is a second interdental papilla. It doesn't really show which is labial or lingual, so we'll just call this lingual and this labial. And say this is the labial interdental papilla, this is the lingual interdental papilla. It sticks up. But in between there is a depression, and that is known as the col. It is literally a depression of the gingiva. And this is where the junctional epithelium of the free gingiva, which I will define for you in a moment, comes together. So this is the area where those two fuse together, those two junctional epithelia fuse together. There is no sulcus in the area of the col. If there is a question at the end about that, I'll come back to it. I realize that my diagram is out of place as far as that is concerned. I can't help that. Okay, so now let's talk about free gingiva. Marginal free gingiva. 1.5 to 2 millimeters. I think 2 millimeters is a fair number also. Then you have the papillary free gingiva. You have a labial or buccal interdental papilla, a lingual or palatal interdental papilla, and in between the depression or col. Fine, that's just the thing. Now here is the section. Now this is a perfectly beautiful picture because it shows the whole thing. You might say that this is the free gingival line, free gingival line. And so everything that is occlusal to that is the free gingiva. Okay, so on the out, and that is the marginal thing, the marginal free gingiva. The free gingiva, in essence, is that part of the gingiva where you have a corresponding folding over of the epithelium that faces the tooth. So that is the definition of the free gingiva. You also notice that on the outside surface, the gingiva is still of a keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. It still has a keratinized stratified squamous epithelium on the outside surface. On the inside surface that faces the tooth, it is a non-keratinized. So it is keratinized here. It is non-keratinized on the side that faces the tooth surface. And now when you look at this, you can actually make a boundary, because there are two sets of epithelia that we need to talk about. This is the sulcular epithelium, and this is the junctional epithelium. This is where the actual attachment is formed between the epithelium and the tooth surface. So sulcular epithelium here, facing the tooth but not attached to it, and further down, further cervically, is the junctional epithelium, which faces the tooth and is attached to it. This is the, really, I assure you, the healthy condition, okay? This is the point where the epithelium ends, where the enamel ends. It's perfect. That is just the way it ought to be. Now, I want you to look at the interface between the connective tissue and the epithelium on both sides. Notice that on the side of the free gingiva, you have these deep epithelial retipegs that extend into the connective tissue. On the side of the junctional epithelium, on the other hand, is a very smooth surface. So that's immediately something that they say, hey, that's very different. The smooth surface is kind of lost at the level of the sulcular epithelium, but at the level of the junctional epithelium, it is entirely smooth. Now, I promised you yesterday that I would come back to the retipex and explain to you what we are looking at. And what you're seeing here is actually a preparation, a scanning EM. For some reason it flipped over in my computer, don't worry about it. But the thing is that what you're seeing here, this is about 2 millimeters high. And so aha, you say, that is the free gingiva. So this is the free gingiva. And here below that is the attached gingiva. Okay? And now what has been done, we have literally dissolved removed the connective tissue from this preparation. So what you're looking at is the connective tissue surface of the epithelium of the free gingiva and the attached gingiva. And now notice how the retipegs in the free gingiva are just forming ridges, very, very interesting ridge-like structures, while they occasionally do intersect, however, like here and here. In the attached gingiva, the ridges are much more richly intersected, and they form, in fact, a network. And as you know, the term reti is really meaning net. And so a retipeg is a little epithelial peg that is part of this network. So when you see a diagram, or not a diagram, an actual preparation like this, the word retipegs makes a little bit more sense. In other words, these little epithelial depressions that you're seeing here are in fact part of ridges that do connect with each other. And where the ridges do connect with each other, they actually form an extra deep retipeg, and on the surface, a little depression forms. And so, at the intersections between retipegs, where they connect with each other, you have these little surface depressions which create the orange peel appearance. Okay? Now let's look at the epithelium that faces the tooth. That is, if this part is the free gingiva, and here's the free gingival line at this arrow, this is the epithelium that faces the tooth, and now what you're seeing here is, once again, the sulcular epithelium, which literally the sulcus is formed like this, where the epithelial strand stands off for the enamel surface. And then down here is the junctional epithelium. The capillary patterns are actually different from each other. The sulcular epithelium has regular connective tissue papillae. That was not a smooth interface. That was an interface with a series of epithelial retipegs. And so you see the blood vessels underneath there are the typical blood vessels that you find in the connective tissue papillae. Underneath the junctional epithelium, you find a smooth and fine network. This is sulcular, showing the little blood vessel, a very complex blood vessel trees that are in the connective tissue papillae. Here is a smooth, flat capillary network that lies underneath that smooth surface of the junctional epithelium. How does a junctional epithelium develop? Junctional epithelium develops from the remnants of the enamel organ. The reduced enamel epithelium, in fact, gives rise to one more structure, and that is the primary junctional epithelial attachment. And so what you have here, just remember this, it's quite remarkable. The enamel organ first is involved in shaping the dentinoenamel junction. Then the inner enamel epithelial cells are involved in inducing the odontoblast. They then turn into secretory ameloblast, maturation ameloblast, then become reduced enamel epithelium, give a stimulus for the eruption of the tooth. And now they're doing one more thing, and it becomes the junctional epithelium, the first epithelial attachment of the tooth when it first erupts. And this happens in the final stages of the eruptive movement as the tooth gets ready to emerge into the oral cavity. And what you typically find at that point, as the two epithelia approach, this is the REE, and here, of course, is the oral epithelium. And when the two epithelia approach, you notice there is a certain amount of proliferation in the reduced enamel epithelium. This is the old kind of schwach-looking enamel epithelium, very poor, thin, not very anemic is the word. Then all of a sudden, as the epithelia come closer to the oral surface, you notice that it becomes thick. So the reduced enamel epithelium now increases in thickness, and you actually see that increase in thickness kind of moving in a cervical direction and along the line of the arrow. This is the old REE. Here is the proliferating layer of new epithelial cells coming mostly from the outer layers of the reduced enamel epithelium. And so you get a whole refreshed epithelium that is developing here. But still, it is the original reduced enamel epithelium that forms this. And it is then becoming the first attachment. You're seeing it here in diagrammatic format. Reduced enamel epithelium shown here. Oral epithelium here, and then as the tooth emerges into the oral cavity, you notice that the oral epithelium and the reduced enamel epithelium are fused together in this area, and the first epithelial attachment, the first junctional epithelium, is in fact that last remnant, most cervical remnant, of the reduced enamel epithelium. And that, therefore, is now the precursor of junctional epithelium in the future. Of course, the cells will start turning over. You get new cells. But the point is, it is the reduced enamel epithelium that gives rise to the junctional epithelium. So let's now consider this, because what you have here is a very peculiar structure, if you remember. This is the site of the reduced enamel epithelium that faces the connective tissue. Here's connective tissue, and so at this interface we have a basement membrane, right? So there's a basement membrane between the epithelium and the connective tissue. You will also remember that when the enamel organ went into the maturation phase and the ameloblast became maturational ameloblast, there was a new basal lamina redeveloping at the interface between the maturing enamel and the enamel organs. And so here, in this particular location, between the epithelium of the developing junctional epithelium and the tooth surface, there is another basal lamina. And so what you're having here is a sandwich, a junctional epithelium sandwich between two basal laminae. Okay? And the basal lamina on this side, which is part of the basement membrane, is known as the outer basal lamina, while the basal lamina that faces the tooth is known as the inner basal lamina. Just tuck that away, we'll talk about it in a little while. The inner or internal basal lamina is the location, found at the location between the tooth surface and the junctional epithelium. It was the original site of the inner enamel epithelium. Okay, that's great. The external basal lamina is formed between the connective tissues and the junctional epithelium and is the original site of the outer enamel epithelium. Good. That's a way of remembering it and it works fine. Now here you have a diagram of that epithelium. Again, the combination of sulcular and junctional. The two together are known as crevicular epithelium, just another term to bother you with. And here would be the location of the basal lamina, internal basal lamina, and over here is the location of the external basal lamina, so basal lamina here and here, and then somewhere over here the two are continuous. I have to then say if you have basal lamina or a basal lamina-like structure, the attachment of the epithelium to these basal laminae is by hemidesmosomes. So there is a structural attachment of the epithelium to the basal lamina, and the basal lamina in turn is attached to the tooth surface by way of van der Waals forces. I mean, it's not very strong, but it's strong enough. It's actually stronger than the attachment between individual epithelial cells. Now, we have to make a caveat here. The external basal lamina is a regular basal lamina the way you know it, with collagen type 4, with laminins, all the kinds that you expect, heparan sulfate proteoglycans, perlecan, a typical proteoglycans again. All of these, fibronectin is a good composition part of it. So the picture that I showed you yesterday with some of these components, that's all there, and that makes for a true basal lamina. The external basal lamina is structured that way. But the internal basal lamina is not. So it is a basal lamina-like structure, but it is not truly a basal lamina. The internal basal lamina is composed only of laminin 5. Laminin 5 you do not find in a regular basal lamina. So while it looks like a basal lamina and it functions like a basal lamina, its composition and its overall structure are not really the same. Now, clinically, the junctional epithelium is a most important structure. I would like to spend a little time with you on that because that is really very important. It is at a strategic interface, and the strategic interface is between the gingival sulcus, which is filled with microorganisms and their products, and the periodontal tissues, both soft and mineralized, that need to be protected against those bacteria and their products. And what lies in between is the junctional epithelium. So the junctional epithelium has a very important role to play. And in fact, we're beginning to appreciate the functions of the junctional epithelial cells in a really major way. In the past, we would think, oh, well, these junctional epithelial cells, they're there, they proliferate a lot, and they provide attachment to these internal and external basal laminae. But that was pretty much the role that we ascribed to it. But in fact, we now appreciate the fact that these junctional epithelial cells produce, in fact, a series of molecules that help us in the defense against the microorganisms and their products. And there are some very destructive microorganisms that are in your oral cavity, and some of them are particularly capable of breaking down the very epithelium that is supposed to protect you. And one of them is P. gingivalis, Porphyromonas gingivalis, which produces a particular kind of proteinases that actually decompose components of the attachments between the cells. Now, that's a nasty little bit of work, because if the attachments between the cells are going, the path for invasion by the bacteria is clearly open. So this is something that the cells are, in fact, producing molecules to defend themselves against these bacteria, and also defend themselves and defend, therefore, the underlying tissues. The other thing that the epithelial cells of the junctional epithelium do is they produce molecules that actually aid the migration of polymorph nuclear leukocytes, neutrophils, through the junctional epithelium to the sulcus. And to give you an idea, in your dentition, in normal, clinically healthy, I hope you have mostly, about 30,000 of these cells per minute run through junctional epithelia of your teeth. That's an enormous amount. These are, again, attacking the bacteria that are in the sulcus. So there is this situation where the cells are really assisting in the defense against the bacteria in the sulcus. Now let's understand a little bit about how these, the junctional epithelium looks. First of all, this is what I showed you yesterday, and today we are going to look at the bottom diagram. And you notice that the stem cells, in the case of the junctional epithelium, are located pretty much quite adjacent to it in the most basal point of the epithelium that is folded over and faces the tooth surface. And from this group of stem cells, you have the transit amplifying cells that are kind of riding up the hillside here. And these transit amplifying cells, when they are ready to begin differentiating, they move in this direction. They move in this direction. And where they are going is to the floor of the sulcus, where they are becoming exfoliated. The turnover is incredibly fast. Okay, the junctional epithelium turns over at a very high rate, and the number of cells that are being released at the floor of the sulcus is astronomical. Now, does it mean that they undergo mitosis that fast? Well, not quite that fast, but if you appreciate that the sulcus is really only one ring around the tooth surface, and that's only the one location where the epithelial cells are being released. And now think about all these epithelial cells that are proliferating and all moving into that one area. So by the time you get to the floor of the sulcus, the enormous flow of cells that are being desquamated is really quite impressive. And what you find, as far as the nature of this epithelium is concerned, these are not highly differentiated epithelial cells. What they are characterized by is a cytokeratin pattern that is typical of two things, stratum basale and a little bit of fetal skin. Those are the cytokeratins that are present. And so you find these cytokeratins over here. In the stratum basale you typically find them, so that's not a problem, but the entire junctional epithelium. Elias, why are you doing this to me? Okay, get yourself back. Yeah, good. Okay. Coming late and dropping your table. Jeez. Okay. Okay, what you're having here is an epithelium that is not differentiated in the way that stratified epithelium, stratified squamous epithelia are. Throughout they have this basic level of cytokeratins, and that means that these epithelia throughout really are pretty much concentrating on mitoses, and they're doing a lot of that, and concentrating on attachment to the basal laminae. These other proteins that you're seeing, especially Psi3, these are typical of very actively hyperproliferative epithelia. But now when you're looking at an transmission electron micrograph of a junctional epithelium, this is what you see. And let's look at it. This is the area here of the external basal lamina. And you notice that there are epithelial cells here that are located here. And these epithelial cells have long cell extensions that are attached to the basal lamina. But you immediately see, I hope, that this is not your average epithelium. There are very wide intercellular spaces. They're filled with fluid. And in between these cells, that in these spaces, you find a fair number of these neutrophils. PMNs that are moving through that epithelium at a fairly good clip. So these are the neutrophils that are moving through the epithelium, aided by the molecules that are secreted by the epithelial cells. And here, because it is kind of beginning a little bit of inflammation, there are some plasma cells also in these intercellular spaces. There is a batch of cells that you find there. PMNs are obviously the largest number. Lymphocytes, and these are all in healthy epithelia. Lymphocytes, macrophages, Langerhans cells, and as the case here in the pre-inflammatory stage, you have some plasma cells. And so these cells all participate in the defense of the host against bacterial infections. Junctional epithelium, this happens to be of a dog. This is the full length of a junctional epithelium, starting over here at the level of the sulcus of the epithelium. Then over here is an overlap point. And so you're going from the sulcus all the way down to the bottom and the basal end of the junctional epithelium. And you will notice that that epithelium looks messy. Lots of stuff is happening here. There are inflammatory cells. This is not a terrifically inflamed gingiva, but inflammatory cells are present in large numbers anyway. Here the epithelium gets to be awfully thin. This epithelium gets to be thick. So there are enormous variations, and it really is evidence that this is a battlefield of some significance. Okay, now let's talk about the tooth surface, the surface on which the junctional epithelium attaches. And I am going to make some diagrams for you, which I think are important to remember the differences between crown and root development, and how the particular development of the dentino-enamel cementum junction occurs. Let me explain. In the case of the crown, you had, as you will recall, an enamel organ with the four layers that you typically find in an enamel organ. And after that enamel organ has done its bit, you end up with a structure that essentially is reduced enamel epithelium, and it continues to cover, and that's the critical thing, it continues to cover the crown that is completed. Okay, so must remain present. Why is that so important? Why is it important that reduced enamel epithelium remains present? If it does not, and sometimes it doesn't, the hard tissue of the crown, specifically the enamel, becomes exposed to the connective tissue that is over here. And the remnants of the enamel matrix that are still present in the enamel will in fact stimulate the connective tissue cells to become cementoblasts. And so if reduced enamel epithelium is lost from the crown surface before the tooth is actually emerged, you have the possibility of cementum deposition on that enamel. And you will say, well, is that so bad? Well, it is, in fact, because where this happens most often is in teeth that do not erupt terribly fast. For example, the third molar is an example of that. And if the third molar just sits around for a long time in the jaw, may not be able to erupt so easily, reduced enamel epithelium may begin to show little deficiencies and areas where cementum is being formed. Now, when you have cementum being formed, that cementum can now become ankylosed, attached to the surrounding bone. And once you have a direct mineralized tissue attachment from the surrounding bone directly onto the crown becomes part of the remodeling process of the bone. Bone remodels all the time. Dental tissues usually do not. But if you have an ankylosis, a connection of the bone to that crown, you can have a destruction of the crown tissue after a while. So the REE that covers the crown really protects the crown from first ankylosis and then from subsequent remodeling and resorptions. So that is why a reduced enamel epithelium really must remain in place. But now let's look at the situation of the root. The root situation, as you know, you have this simple bilayered epithelial root sheath known as HERS. Here it is, two parts of it. And in the case of the root sheath, things are very different. You don't want the root sheath to persist. You don't want it to remain. The root sheath, in fact, must be destroyed. And it must be destroyed, why? So that the cementoblast can move in and deposit cementum on the root surface. So in this case here, you have a very interesting difference between the crown and the root. Now let's see what happens at the interface between the crown and the root, where you are going to form the junction between dentin, enamel, and cementum. And so I'm going to draw you I'm going to have to do it in a different color. I'm going to draw you an outline of a tooth. This is enamel, this is dentin, and here would be cementum. Okay? Now, if you have a situation where everything goes according to plan, and that is, you have reduced enamel epithelium here, and that stays and covers the enamel until the time of eruption, and this, in fact, is going to form junctional epithelium, and it is exactly staying in place exactly to the point where the enamel ends, and from that point forward you have only remnants of the HERS, epithelial remnants of Malassez. If you have a situation like that, where the epithelium in the crown behaves as it should, that means REE staying in place, and where the epithelium of the root also behaves as it should, that means HERS being disintegrating. When that happens, you get a perfect edge-to-edge, knife-edge junction between those, between the enamel and the cementum. Okay? If that happens, you get a knife-edge relationship. Okay. So that's what you want ideally. Doesn't happen all the time. So now let's see what happens most of the time. What happens most of the time is this. Dentin, enamel, cementum. What you get is a morphology like this, where cementum overlaps a little bit of the enamel. Not dramatically, nothing worrisome, but it overlaps a little bit. And now what would you postulate would have happened? Well, what you postulate is that the reduced enamel epithelium was present and stayed in place, but it didn't go all the way down to where it should have been. It should have been going down as far as this, but it didn't. It became disintegrated. The final cervical part of the reduced enamel epithelium behaved as HERS would do. And so from here on out, you have epithelial remnants. And so cementum forms, and cementum forms in part on top of the enamel of the cervix. Capiche? So you get overlap. Nothing too horrible about this. This is the most frequently found relationship. And now comes the final relationship. That is one that's going to give you some horror. Because now what you have is the following. Enamel, dentin, and cementum. This relationship, where you have a gap between the enamel and the cementum, is produced by the fact that you have, again, typically reduced enamel epithelium, and the reduced enamel epithelium sits nicely on the enamel, does what it's supposed to do. But now what happens is the epithelium of the root sheath, the most coronal part of it, does not do what it's supposed to do. What it does, it continues to be present for a little distance and does not disappear, and only at this point does it disintegrate. Okay, so here you have a situation where the coronal part of HERS does not behave as it should. And in this case, we get a gap. a gap between enamel and cementum. Is that a problem? Well, the problem is as follows. The junctional epithelium in this case will actually run, it starts on the dentin, and then it goes all the way where it normally should be on the enamel. See, in this case here, you would have junctional epithelium on the enamel. Here you would have junctional epithelium on the enamel. Fine, no problem at all. But in this case, you have junctional epithelium on the enamel and on the little bit of dentin that is not covered by cementum. And that's all right as long as the epithelium does not regress during periodontal disease. So if you have epithelial regression, gingival regression, as a result of periodontal disease, there will come a time when the dentin is no longer protected by epithelium and now is exposed to the oral cavity. And when that happens, you get a certain amount of pain in that area, the painful necks of the teeth, and you will also have the possibility of rapid caries lesions in that area. So now let's look at the situation. These are three pictures that I'm going to show you, scanning EMs of the dentino-enamel cementum junction. And here is a perfect beauty, and what you find here is edge-to-edge relationship, and the literature in oral histology says traditionally that this relationship occurs in 30% of the cases. That number sticks with us. It sticks with us forever. But the figure actually is not proven. It's not found often, but it is, the number 30 is definitely a question mark. And the other thing that I have to tell you is that if you find this relationship on one side of the tooth, it may not necessarily be present on the other side of the tooth. So within a tooth, you can have different relationships between enamel and cementum. But this is the typical edge-to-edge relationship. Enamel is here, and it stops here, and now cementum begins. Here is the usual thing. The number that is traditionally associated with it, 60%. I would like you to remember that this is the most common relationship that you find. And what you're seeing here is enamel, and here you see little bits of cementum kind of lapping over the enamel. It's kind of a cute little picture. And the final picture here, the least common, but the number 10%, which we normally associated with, is again an unproven figure. And what you see here is the enamel ends here, the cementum begins here, and then there's this area in between of exposed dentin. This is exposed dentin, and the dentinal tubules are open to the surface. Okay? Direct path into the pulp if that occurs. I want you to do a little mind experiment, folks, and figure out why you cannot have a situation where enamel overlaps cementum. Okay? You have cementum overlapping enamel. Figure out why you cannot have enamel overlapping cementum. Okay. Now let's finish up with a few structures that you find at the interface between the junctional epithelium and the tooth surface. There are a couple that we encounter. First one that is strictly a laboratory artifact. And that's known as Nasmyth's membrane. Nasmyth did an experiment. He took a newly erupted tooth, put it in a little bit of hydrochloric acid, 10%, a couple of hours, and what he found was that a membrane came floating off that tooth surface. What is the membrane composed of? Well, as best as we can tell, reduced enamel epithelium, whatever was left of it on the tooth surface, some organic matrix that had not really yet mineralized completely, and some oral organic materials. It had already been deposited on it. So this is a membrane that is literally produced by a laboratory intervention. Okay? So if you encounter that, that is not a structure we worry about too much in vivo. We do worry about this one, dental cuticle. Dental cuticle is a pretty thin little layer of organic material, and it is found literally between the tooth surface and the internal basal lamina. It's called by some people a supplementary lamina densa, And it is very, very possible that as the internal basal lamina is being deposited on the enamel surface by the cells of the junctional epithelium, it is just possible that there is a certain amount of apposition, gradual increase in thickness that accounts for this particular structure. It has no real clinical significance, but it forms usually post-eruptively, increases with age, may even be mineralized. Oh, that's really wild. And it's going to intrigue you like nothing else. You're going to all try to find it. Okay. And then finally, there are on the tooth surface patches of a peculiar material that we call cementum. But I'm not sure I would like to call it cementum, really. But it's called cementum, so we stick with it. Acellular afibrillar cementum. It's GOP. It's GOP that is on the tooth surface. It mineralizes, and God only knows what it amounts to. Okay, let's look at the dental cuticle. Here it is, this little structure between the epithelial cells and the tooth surface. In this case, the tooth surface is AEFC. The epithelium has already migrated down. But you see on this tooth surface, you see this little thin membrane. It's over here. You can see it is kind of blistered off a little area. That is a blister. That is an accident. It's not normal. And so this little bit of this very thin structure that you're seeing here is known as the dental cuticle. Okay? Probably accumulated basal lamina material. And here are these afibrillar, acellular cementum patches. And they typically are already present on an erupting tooth. Here's a tooth that is just erupting, emerged into the oral cavity, and you find that in the area of the free gingiva, next to the junctional epithelium here, you see a few of these little regions indicated in red in this diagram that are patches of this material on the surface of the enamel. Very possibly produced by the cells of the reduced enamel epithelium. When you're looking at it, this is what it looks like. Little accretions of material. They have little lines, mineralization lines in it. Nothing is present. No fibers, no cells. And you're just seeing these little lines at higher power. You see them here. It seems to be material that has, again, been added onto the surface in layers and layers that gradually mineralized. This is what we call acellular afibrillar cementum. So if you come across that word, that's what it means. Lies between the tooth surface and the internal basal lamina. Again, it has no further function. Okay, that's all I wanted to discuss at this point. Let's take a 5-minute break and we'll do the lab introduction.